Welcome back to Engine Talk.
And we're talking about engines. Next caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm Brian. I just changed my oil.
Oh, what motor oil are you using, Brian?
Mobil Super Synthetic.
Hello! Smart man. You know, synthetics are a great way to protect your engine.
Oh, yeah, my engine works great.
So, what's the problem, Brian?
Nothing.
No issues at all?
Well, I have this rash on my thigh.
Wrong show, Brian.
Mobil Super Synthetic, now at AutoZone for $3.99 a quart. Super protection, super price. Certain restrictions apply. See store for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You tell me. You call home. Should call home back.
Hi, this is Amy Alcon. One of my best qualities is that I'm annoying. And, okay, it's also one of my worst qualities, one of my most annoying qualities. But when I see something that's solid science, I really want people to know. And I pretty much annoy them about it until they listen. And that's what I've been doing. I've been blogging and writing about the work of Dr. Michael Eads and Dr. Mary Dan Eads, who are two of the all too few people out there who are practicing evidence-based dietary medicine. Now, lots of people will tell you they are, but these two truly are, and you can tell because they lay out the evidence in great detail, in very understandable detail, in their blogs and in their books. So you can see that, yes, it is truly evidence-based. Now, between them, the Eads have written 15 books, including the mega New York Times bestseller Protein Power, which sat on the New York Times bestseller list and refused to leave for 63 weeks. Protein Power Life Plan is also really great, and so is their website. It's proteinpower.com, and you will find both of their blogs there. Now, I just want to say, for one of the best ads of what they do, complete with pictures, Google the words Free the Animal, which is the name of a blog, Free the Animal, and my last name, Alcon, and you'll see a story that I hear at least twice a week from somebody who's read my blog and read links to the Eads. I link to them all the time because they do such great work with such great science behind it. This is a researcher's story. She's a biologist from Georgia, and it's complete with pictures. This woman had gotten pregnant, and she had gained 70 pounds, and she could not, for the life of her, lose these 70 pounds. Well, I annoyed the hell out of her, and she, too, looked at the Eads' work and decided that they were solid on science, and like so many people who follow the Eads' advice, she dropped a whole bunch of weight, 70 pounds, and kind of like they were stones falling off a truck. So, of course, I had to do the Eads on my radio show. And this is also not just for people who want to lose weight, but for people like me who realize that we could all live a long time and we better eat healthy or there are going to be some miserable years up there when we get old. So, hello, Dr. Michael Eads and Dr. Mary Dan Eads.
Hello, Amy.
Hi there.
So you two, you're way ahead of the curve in understanding that cutting carbs is the way to get healthy and lose weight. So tell me about your history on that.
Well, we were in clinical practice for a long time, just as regular family practice doctors. We had a chain of clinics in Little Rock, Arkansas that we ran, and we had about 50 doctors working with us. And at one point when I reached my mid-30s, I just all of a sudden exploded almost like a kernel of popcorn. I mean, it came from out of nowhere. I'd been thin all my life, thin and athletic. I played college football. I always wanted to gain weight. I was never as heavy as I wanted to be. And then things changed, and it just kind of happened all at once. And suddenly I was fighting a weight problem, and I actually didn't fight it very well for a while. I just kind of rolled with the punches and gained more and more and more weight until I had really ballooned up to over about 40 pounds over what I should have been. And I decided to get serious about it. And being a family medicine kind of guy where you take care of everything that comes through the door, I decided, hey, this is something that I can really get my arms around, and I can look into weight loss, and maybe I can kind of specialize that in a way. And so I started looking, and the first place I looked at was in my old medical school biochemistry text, and I started looking up fat and what makes you store fat. And I see this arrow that says insulin makes you store fat. It stimulates the enzyme that stores fat in the human fat cell. And so then I looked up insulin, and then everything I read about insulin just showed that it made you fat, it made your blood pressure go up, it made blood vessel walls get thicker, it made fat get stored in the liver, it did a million things. And I was surprised to find all that because I was, like most doctors, and just associated insulin kind of with diabetes. And so I started putting myself on a diet to reduce my own insulin level, because if you take anybody in medical school and you say, what makes insulin go up? They say carbohydrates. So it made sense that if you took the carbohydrates out of the diet, insulin would go down. And I did that, and I lost weight like crazy. And when I did, patients that I were taking care of, saw it and said, hey, Doc, what are you doing? You're losing weight. And I would say, I've come up with this diet that I've been working on. And they said, well, can you put me on that diet? And so I would put them on the diet, and they would lose weight. And the next thing you know, my practice had transmogrified from just a basic, you know, primary care medical practice into a practice taking care of overweight people with diet. And so in a nutshell, that's what happened. And then my wife, MD, joined me in that practice, and we have done that since.
And so can you tell us about some of the stories? Just tell like a story or two of patients, how they have come in and how their lives have changed by changing their diet this way.
Gosh, over the years we've had so many patients, it's hard to kind of pluck a few out, but let me see. Early on in our practice, actually I hadn't even joined Mike in it. We got to remember this is back in the mid 1980s when we were starting out here doing this, and I was still working just as a family doc, and he was really getting more and more weight loss and metabolic patients who wanted to see him. In fact, it was taking up most of his time, and I had a lady who was early to mid 30s. Who came in, and she came in to see me at our family practice clinic because she had she was having stomach pain. And so I examined her and go through all the things that you think of when you have a woman who has right upper quadrant pain, which is kind of up on the right side of the abdomen. And so I was worried that she might have gallbladder disease. That's the big one that first comes to your mind. And so I did some tests on her and got some ordered some ultrasounds, did some things to see if she maybe had gallbladder disease, and it turned out that she didn't have gallbladder disease, but what she did turn out having was triglycerides that were about 3,500. Normal triglycerides are 150, 100, lower than that if you're on a low-carb diet. Hers were 3,500, and in fact, in my medical practice, I had never seen somebody with triglycerides at 3,500, and she had basically the right upper quadrant discomfort was from fatty liver. And so I sent her over to Mike at his clinic because I thought maybe the diet, from everything he had been saying and everything we'd been reading and going back through the textbooks that it would be of benefit to her. So he actually put her on a very low-carb diet, basically meat, salad, and green vegetables and nothing else. And in 2 weeks, her triglycerides were normal. And she had lost, 10 or 12. She wasn't all that overweight, but she'd lost 10 or 12 pounds in a two-week period, and her pain was gone. She was feeling great. So I think the thing that's the most amazing about, a really well-done, good-sound, low-carb diet is how incredibly fast it works to reverse metabolic conditions. Losing weight is a horse of a different color, and it takes some time to do that. You have to physically get rid of those calories, but it's an amazing thing, and we've had stories in our practice over and over and over again that are like that.
Yeah, we had a bunch of people come in early on like that had horrendous cholesterol or triglyceride problems, and it was interesting because I had discovered this as a weight loss tool, and people really lost weight on it quickly. They liked it. They felt satisfied. They felt full. They didn't feel deprived. But I had this little niggling worry because you got to remember this was right in the midst of this whole low-fat era where everybody was scared to death of fat and scared to death of saturated fat. And I was putting these patients on a fair amount of both fat and saturated fat, so I was a little bit nervous about that, although I kept a close watch on their labs. But then we had this lady that Mary Dan sent me, and then I had three others just kind of in quick succession, all that had bad lipid profiles. and I treated those all with the diet. I mean, bad, out of the ballpark bad. Treated all those with the diet, watched them like a hawk, called them at home, gave them my home telephone number because I was so concerned about it, and they all normalized. One guy normalized, I think, in 11 days. So it really works quickly. And so then, even though the textbook said that by reducing insulin you should lower triglycerides and you should change all these lipid parameters, until I saw it with my own eyes, I didn't really believe it, and I didn't feel comfortable really and just whole scale giving people this program. But now we've seen so many that I use it to treat that now.
It's kind of incredible, because you think, I eat this greasy bacon, I eat meat and steak and green beans drowning in butter, and you feel like, you know, we're taught that, you know, the Puritan work ethic that things should be ascetic or they're not good for you. And so it's kind of amazing, but I've seen this from so many of my blog commenters who've lost all this weight. And I want to get into all the nitty-gritty of what to do and why to do it, but I just wanted to backtrack a little bit to, you know, we're talking about, I think it's the 70s, maybe the late 70s, I'm not sure of the exact year, but, you know, we have this huge obesity epidemic in this country. And what people don't understand, that's what's so sick, is that basically big government is big fat government. And, you know, we had this shoddy research by a guy named Ansel Keys, and that went into the food pyramid, which was created by a guy who worked for George McGovern with no science experience. And then all these people started eating this low-fat diet. Can you tell us why what Ansel Keys' research was and why it was such crap?
He did some good research too, but he did some stuff that was a little bit iffy, and he's not really as much to blame probably as the people are that set the food pyramid. I mean, he Ansel Keys was a believer in the low carb theory of what? Ansel Keys was a believer in the low fat theory of dieting, not low carb. That's why I keep her around, to keep me in line.
That's right.
He was a believer in low carb, and he thought that fat was a problem. Although I think in his later years he came around a little bit. But anyway, he was kind of a bad guy academically. I mean, everybody sort of feared him. He had a lot of academic power, so everybody sort of fell under his sway. And the people that actually put this food pyramid together, one of them was a vegetarian. And, you know, McGovern was from, I can't remember now, either North or South Dakota, which is a huge wheat-growing state. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but basically they put this all together based on absolutely no science. I mean, based on zero science whatsoever, they put this together and then structured it in such a way that you have to have real science to overturn it. And nutritional science is really difficult to come by because it's difficult to get funding. You can't make money selling nutrition. You can make money selling drugs, so there's no end of money for pharmaceutical research, but there is a dearth of money for real nutritional research. So it's difficult to overcome these nutritional guidelines, and people say, well, you know, who cares? They're just government guidelines, and nobody pays any attention to them anyway. But that's not really true, because 53 million people get fed by the government every day. These are people that have school lunches. These are people in prisons. These are people in the military. These are people in all walks of life that end up being the beneficiary of some sort of government food program. And the way the nutritional guidelines are set up is that any governmental agency that provides food to people has to follow the nutritional guidelines. So these crappy nutritional guidelines are now being presented to 53 million people every day. So don't kid yourself, it does make a difference about the nutritional guidelines.
Yeah, and people believe this. I always have people, you know, you hear them on TV talking about healthy whole grains, and of course there's nothing healthy about them. And you know, all these ideas we have that people widely hold about heart disease, which you call rightly coronary artery disease in your book. I want to just quote from in Chapter 4 of the Protein Power Life Plan, which is the chapter Cholesterol, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You write, not since the witch trials of Salem has such an all-out campaign been launched against the innocent based on so little truth and so much misinformation. You're talking here about cholesterol. So tell us what the misinformation is about cholesterol and what the good information is.
Cholesterol is just a waxy kind of a molecule that's called a structural fat, and it's extremely important in the human body. A huge proportion of our brain is composed of cholesterol. Cholesterol is in every cell. If we were to somehow have some kind of a machine that could suck the cholesterol out of us, we would just fall into a puddle like the Wicked Witch and the Wizard of Oz. I mean, it's a structural fat, and it's extremely important, and it's so important that virtually every cell in the body can make cholesterol. Okay, every cell can make cholesterol. Now, most of it's made in the liver, some of it's made in the small intestine, some of it's made in a couple of other organs, but the majority of it is made in the liver. But every cell has the capacity to make cholesterol, and it's always seemed strange to me that if this were such a bad thing, why are we set so that every cell can make it? And the cholesterol got wrongly indicted in this whole lipid hypothesis. And the lipid hypothesis basically says that that basically saturated fat makes your cholesterol go up, and elevated cholesterol causes heart disease. And it's still, years later, after billions of dollars have been spent on statins and other cholesterol-lowering drugs, this is still just a hypothesis. It's not a fact, because there has never really been any solid proof that cholesterol causes heart disease.
Wait, can you say that again? Because that's so important, and people don't believe this when I tell them this.
Oh, I know, because it's everywhere. It's widespread that cholesterol does not cause heart disease. Now, the interesting thing is, and Gary Taubes, you and I and MD know really well, when he wrote a book called Good Calories, Bad Calories, he sort of tracked this whole thing back. And, you know, when you read medical studies, every statement that's made in a medical study is cited, gives you a citation that you can go look up the medical study that provides the basis for whatever was said in this one. So you can sort of just tunnel your way back through the medical literature looking for where did this whole idea come from that cholesterol is bad and causes heart disease. And when you start tracking it all the way back, as Gary did, there's nothing to it. And
it's
so it's amazing to me that it's as widespread as it is. And part of the reason is, of course, the drug companies want you to believe that cholesterol is bad for you, so you'll buy their cholesterol-lowering drugs, which are the largest-selling drugs in the world right now.
And you write about something, too, because you write about the ways that you can actually become healthy, and you talk, too, about in Protein Power Life Plan that you care less about lowering the LDL cholesterol number than preventing the damage it does, you know, while all these people are very hung up on the number.
Right, and it's, normal LDL, good, you know, quality LDL isn't a problem. And it's when it gets damaged, when it gets oxidized, when it gets glycated, when certain things happen to it, that it gets picked up by the scavenger receptors and can cause a problem. But even then, you know, there are two different types of cholesterol. There are big, fluffy types of LDL cholesterol, and that there are these small, dense, BB kind of types of LDL cholesterol. And the only ones that have really shown any correlation with heart disease are the small, dense ones. And it just so happens that if you follow a low-fat diet, low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, you create more small, dense LDL particles. Whereas if you switch over and follow a low-carb, high-fat diet, you convert your cholesterol, your LDL particles to the big, fluffy ones that some people think are not only not harmful but actually helpful. And that's been shown in at least a half a dozen studies. Switching people from a low-fat to a low-carb diet will completely switch their LDL particle size picture from one that's bad to one that's good.
This is something that you've blogged about and that a lot of people really understand very well, because a lot of these words, lipid hypothesis and everything, they're very hard for people to grasp. But I linked to one of your blog items where you wrote about that the problem is that these large, the small, dense particles, those are the ones that slip through, and those are the ones that stick to your arteries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can be thought of that way, right.
Yeah, so because you make things, one thing I love about your blog, and this is Amy Alcon, I should tell you, I'm talking with Dr. Michael Eads and Dr. Mary Dan Eads, and they are at the forefront of low-carb eating, and they are very evidence-based, which is why I love them. Their book is Protein Power, and another is Protein Power Life Plan, and their site is proteinpower.com.
We'll be back after this message from our sponsor. We're back.
You make things very accessible, and one thing I love is how you both on your blogs, you explain things in ordinary terms for ordinary people, and I think that's very good. So I have a question for MD. This is Dr. Mary Danides. You wrote on your blog about the low-fat diet. This is another incredible thing, debunking this myth. You write, study after study has shown the low-fat diet to be a failure in treating obesity, in solving diabetes, in reducing blood pressure, or in decreasing heart disease risk. So all these people are eating this terrible food for no benefit.
For no benefit. Yeah. I know, it's really kind of sad. I remember, I think it was in about April of 1993, maybe, Mike and I were at a medical meeting where really luminaries in obesity research from all over the world were speaking at this conference that was about dietary lipids in human health and disease. Mike says it was 96, April of 96. But anyway, we sat there and watched these people struggle with the fact that they were all realizing that the low-fat diet had been a dismal failure, and they truly didn't know what to do because they felt like they couldn't come out and say that it was a complete failure because then nobody would believe anything they said ever the rest of their lives. But, I mean, that's – how many years ago was that now? 16 years ago that – the people within the obesity research community understood that the low-fat diet was a dismal failure, but you don't hear that in the mainstream press. They're still telling people to eat less fat, exercise more, and all will be well.
It's so disgusting. And actually, you write about exercise. You know, these misconceptions on exercise. You have you talk about slow burn. Tell us what the misconceptions are that people hold on exercise, and what's the smarter way to think about it?
First, let me say this and get it out of the way. There's been no evidence that shows that exercise brings about weight loss. That seems totally off the wall to say that, but it really is true. Exercise tends to make you a little bit more hungry. You eat more food. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take but an extra forkful of food to make up for a whole lot of exercise. People don't realize how few calories they really burn with exercise. Now, exercise has a plethora of benefits, and I like to exercise myself. I recommend that all my patients exercise. It's good for you. It's good for your, for your heart. It's good for all kinds of things, but it's just not a particularly good way to lose weight. Now, I know a lot of people are going to say, well, I went out and I ran, 20 miles and I started doing this and I lost weight. Yeah. You can do that. But what I'm saying is that there have been no studies where they've randomized people into two groups and given one people exercise, put the other people on just a regular sedentary diet and have it shown that exercise really brings about weight loss. So that's the first thing I'm going to say. Now, the second thing I'm going to say is that there is really no such thing per se as cardiovascular fitness. What cardiovascular fitness means, basically, it has nothing to do with your heart and your lungs. It has to do with oxygen and nutrients getting across the membrane into the cells. And when you are out of shape and you try to run around the block, you end up puffing and panting and your heart is pounding. And what's happening is you can't get nutrients across this membrane. Those systems have not been geared up to transport the nutrients into the cells that need them because they're exercising. And so what you do to compensate is you try to get as much oxygen in your blood as you can, and your heart goes pump, 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 because it's trying to get as much blood circulated as it can. Now, when you exercise and you get in shape, what happens? Your heart doesn't really change. Your lungs don't really change. What changes is the ability to transport nutrients across the cell. And when that happens, now you go out and run around the block, and you're not puffing and panting, your heart's not pounding because you're providing plenty of nutrients to the cell because you've gotten in shape, and in doing so, you've increased the transport of nutrients into the cell. So it all happens at the level of the cell. Most people don't realize that. When you go out and get in shape, you don't get bigger lungs and a bigger heart. You get an improvement in this transport of nutrients.
So it's a metabolic thing.
Right. And when you look at any kind of exercise, I don't care if it's aerobics, I don't care if it's jogging, and I didn't believe this myself until I delved into the medical literature and found it out, but when you have any kind of aerobic kind of exercise, the benefit that you get from that is an increase in strength. That's the benefit that you get from it. You get an increase in strength. And in this increase in strength, you get the conditioning effect that allows these nutrients to go across the membrane faster. So if you say the benefit that we get from aerobic exercise is an increase in strength, maybe we ought to exercise in a way that builds strength. And so then you have to ask yourself, what's the best way to increase your strength? Well, it's obvious. You do resistance training. That increases strength better than anything does. I mean, aerobic training increases the strength of your pelvic girdle a little bit, and your legs, and the muscles in your butt. But if you do resistance training, you have this conditioning effect all over it, and you can work a lot of big muscles and really get the conditioning effect quickly. And then you say, okay, so resistance exercise is the best way to increase strength, which is, after all, the benefit of any kind of an exercise. What's the best kind of resistance exercise? And based on the research that I've done in the medical literature, the best way is to do this slow motion training, because it keeps the muscle under strain longer. It fatigues the muscle fibers. When the muscle fiber is fatigued, they send out signals that sort of accelerate this entire systemic conditioning process, and the studies have shown that you can actually build muscle mass faster. And so that's the whole idea of slow burn, which is the title of a book that we co-wrote with a trainer
about slow motion
training.
Is this lifting heavy weight slowly?
No, it's lifting light weight slowly, because that's part of the problem, is that people tend to get hurt if they lift heavy weights, because what they do is they use momentum. So they're focused on how much they can lift. And so let's say they're doing a bench press and they lay down and they have this weight on it and they give a mighty grunt and throw this up, and then they hold it up braced on their arm and take a couple of breaths and then let it drop back down. And slow motion training is using a lighter weight but keeping the muscle under tension constantly by moving it very slowly so that there's no momentum involved, never straightening your arm completely out and starting coming back and taking 20 to 30 seconds to do a complete rep. And what you want to do is you want to do it until your muscles fail, and you gauge the amount of weight that it takes so that your muscles fail in about 60 to 90 seconds. And if you go longer than 90 seconds, you need to go up on the weight a little bit. If you fail before 60 seconds, you need to decrease the weight. And if you do that, it really takes about 12 to 15 minutes every 5 days for an optimal workout. And the neat part is the benefit comes not while you're doing it. The benefit comes from the recovery.
Wow. This is incredible. So 12 to 15 minutes every 5 days. Do you mean that you do it once every 5 days, or?
Yeah, that's optimal. You can, the effects will last if you do it, up to about 10 days. You don't want to do it sooner because you want the muscles to heal, because this is a fairly brutal workout. It doesn't sound like it, but it is. You're kind of trading quality for quantity in your exercise.
No, the other way around.
And when it's over with, you are whipped, and so it takes you a few days to recover. But when the recovery process is when the good things happen, and so you don't want to do this every 2 or 3 days, or you'll get into kind of an overtraining syndrome.
And then how much do you balance that with cardio, with say biking or something like that? How much time do you have to put in for that to be healthy?
Well, as a matter of fact, what we recommend is that you separate in your mind the idea of exercise and recreation. Exercise is doing the 12 to 15 minutes of slow motion resistance training or slow burn training, and that's where you build your strength. And recreation is what you do active that you just enjoy. So I don't particularly recommend, unless somebody truly enjoys sitting on a cardio cycle in the gym and grinding away, forever and a day, I don't necessarily recommend that they do it at all. If what they enjoy is playing tennis, I'd rather they get out there and do that. Or if what they enjoy is hiking in the wilderness, I'd rather they do that. Or if they like to swim or, whatever they like to do. But I don't particularly think that people need to do specific cardio training, because, as we said, the cardio benefit comes from the metabolic conditioning at the cellular level that you get, that really happens during the recovery between strength training bouts.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, do I really have to leave my desk other than the weights?
If the weights are close enough to your desk, you don't.
So I'm not going to, my brain, what? I don't need cardio for my brain and for my heart.
I don't think you do. If you do this slow motion, slow burn kind of exercise once a week, I think that's plenty. I mean, that's what I do.
That's great news. That's wonderful. Go ahead and
that's
read that
nice
book.
Because you do that for your fitness, and then you do the other stuff if you want it for fun. I mean, a lot of people get out and they walk or they jog or they do this aerobics and they don't particularly enjoy it a lot. And but they do it because sort of this grim determination, because they feel like they have to do it for fitness, and they don't. You can spend your 15 or 20 minutes once a week, and then instead of going out on a jog, you can just take a long nap.
That's fantastic. I'm really liking this. So I guess I should backtrack a little bit, just in case anybody doesn't really understand what low-carb eating is. Can you just give me a real quick rundown for anybody who doesn't know, and then we'll move on to these other very interesting questions I have.
Well, low-carb eating is a restriction in the starch, primarily the starch and sugar component of the diet. For the differences are, if you're maintaining, you can probably tolerate, most people can probably tolerate about 60 effective grams of carbohydrate a day. Down to, you might need to go down to as low as 20 in some people if you are really metabolically resistant. You're trying to correct metabolic conditions. And
can
so,
I just ask you, because I want to, what is 60 grams of carbohydrate? Would that be a plate of pasta or what would it, or an apple? What would it be?
It's probably about 20 grams in an apple, a medium-sized apple, 18 to 20 grams, I would say. So when you're counting carbohydrate grams, you want to try to get the most bang for your buck. So you gravitate naturally toward things that are fairly low in starch and sugar, so there's not a lot of carbohydrate grams in them. So that's why green leafy things, greened vegetables, squashes, berries, those kind of things that are relatively low, broccoli, asparagus, cauliflower, those kind of things have so little carb in them that you can eat a lot of that kind of food along with your protein and fat and not hit 60 grams.
But some people, you write about one of the things I love in your book, Protein Power Life Plan, and I'm talking with Dr. Mike Leeds and Dr. Mary Dan Eads. You give the different diets for people who are fanatics about it and then for people who want to sort of, you know, not be so fanatic about it. And so you have those different levels. And so some people, though, just need to be very ascetic about not eating anything other than, you know, bacon and hamburgers and steak and things like that.
Yeah, that's true. There are people that are more carbohydrate intolerant than others, and what we're talking about is intolerance to carbohydrates. There are some people that are very carbohydrate tolerant. In fact, a study was done back in the 80s at Stanford where they took young, healthy people and they put them through a process basically to measure their glucose tolerance and how well insulin worked, and what they found out is that 20% of those people, even though they were young, healthy, didn't have any weight to lose, and didn't have elevated blood sugar, it took a lot more insulin to keep their blood sugar stable than it did the people at the other end of the spectrum. So 20% of people probably are really badly carb intolerant, and 20% of people are really carb tolerant, and then you've got this sort of gradation in between. So I would say probably 20% of people can get by eating carbs, and they seem to do fine, and they stay thin, they don't seem to gain weight, they don't have a lot of the other problems, but the other 80% of us do, and it's in varying degrees that people have this carbohydrate intolerance, and the more intolerant you are, the worse you are on this scale, the more you're going to have to restrict carbohydrates to really do well on a low-carbohydrate diet.
But as I said at the beginning, this isn't just for people who need to lose weight, and you know, if I ate flour more than I do, I wouldn't be the Hindenburg, you know, that size. But you talked to me about how it seems possible that Alzheimer's, for example, is diabetes of the brain, and you've talked about the, you know, the damaging effects of flour. And so, I mean, wouldn't that be a reason to at least eliminate flour and sugar?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely, there are a lot of problems with flour above and beyond just the fact that it's a really concentrated source of carbohydrate. It's a obviously it's from grain, it's from wheat. Wheat is an item that has come on to the human menu very recently in our evolutionary past. Depending on where you are, anywhere from 5 to 10,000 years ago, which is a blink of the eye in evolutionary time, and we really haven't had the chance to adapt to that completely. And it's any kind of new food creates problems. I mean, I just read an interesting article the other day about they tested Australian Aborigines, and they gave them kangaroo meat, the red meat that they've eaten for eons. They gave them an equal amount of beef from a new breed of beef cattle, and they showed all kinds of inflammatory response to the new beef, and they showed no inflammatory response to the kangaroo. So over time, we adapt to our diet, and we just haven't had time to adapt to wheat yet. And to make matters worse, 40 or 50 years ago, they genetically modified the wheat, and instead of these tall amber waves of grain kind of wheat that we think about as wheat that, you know, when I was a kid, was up, you know, practically head high to me, and now they've got this dwarf wheat that's only 18 inches high. It's got a much higher yield per acre. It doesn't get knocked down and blown down by storms and hail and all the other things that cause wheat farmers grief. But it's even newer, and people have a higher incidence of celiac disease with that, and since it's new, they probably have a higher incidence of all kinds of inflammatory problems with them. So I think wheat is just better off avoided altogether.
And I just want to get into, before we move on, I wanted to ask Mary Dan about frankenfats. But Mike, you were telling me a couple of weeks ago about how a person's metabolism can get broken. And, you know, this sort of relates to what you were saying before. And I was wondering if, you know, if people who have, you know, there are people that go on and off low-carb diets, if this low-carb, this yo-yo low-carbing, you know, is damaging, maybe more so to these people, or is it okay for anyone?
No, I think it's okay for anyone, and it's and when I say your metabolism is broken, that's a highly technical term.
Yeah.
No one really knows what happens. The speculation is that it's the mitochondria, the little organelles inside the cells that provide the or produce the energy that somehow get damaged or become dysfunctional. Nobody really knows what it is, but there seems to be a point at which people suddenly begin to have a lot of difficulty. I mean, they can pick up a little weight beforehand, they lose it quickly, they may gain it back, they lose it quickly, they don't have a problem, and then all of a sudden they reach this point at which it suddenly becomes difficult. And a part of it is aging, because people do get a little bit less glucose or less carb tolerant as they age. And so they hit a point at which it just really becomes problematic to lose weight. And whereas before it came off easily, now you have to work at it. And they sometimes say, well, it, you know, it doesn't work for me as well this time. Well, you know, they did it 3 years ago. They're 3 years older now than they were then. It's going to be harder even if everything else were equal just because they're older. So I think that once people reach the point that this metabolism is broken, that a low-carb diet is the absolute best diet that they can be on, and I don't know that they're ever going to fix it, but they keep it in check.
Yeah, so they keep their health in check, too, besides staying slimmer. So, Mary Jan, I wanted to ask you, you're so funny, I wanted to ask you about the frankenfats, mm-hmm. as you called them on your blog, the partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, and the reason you use lard.
Well, frankenfats are, you know, fats created in the lab like the Frankenstein monster. So they take vegetable oils, and if you think about it, those are not exactly natural oils. Some of them are squeezed out of seeds, which are naturally oily, but, you know, corn oil and other vegetable oils are, you don't squeeze corn and get corn oil. You get corn juice. So all of those are sort of chemically and unnaturally extracted to be able to be put in a bottle, and then they are quite unstable on the shelf because they are polyunsaturated, which means that they're prone to go rancid, to become rancid when exposed to oxygen and to light. So the manufacturers partially hydrogenate them, which means that they they unsaturate them to a degree. I mean, that they saturate them to a degree. They fill up some of those unsaturated bonds with hydrogen so that, they'll stay stable on the shelf. But it makes them an unnaturally configured fat, and so they're not particularly good for us. Lard, on the other hand, is actually a fairly stable, naturally saturated fat with a fatty acid profile not that unlike human breast milk. It's actually fairly similar to, and olive oil as well. They're all three of those things are fairly similar fatty acid profiles. And so lard is my choice for high-temperature frying. I mean, it's a thing I use in all kinds of cooking applications because it's stable.
And does this? Can you use lard at high temperatures?
You can. You absolutely can. Beef tallow, which is sort of the same thing from cows instead of pigs, beef tallow was what used to be used in McDonald's to fry their French fries back when they really had tasty French fries. I hate to say that word in conjunction with a discussion about diet. I certainly don't eat McDonald's French fries anymore, but back in the day, they were, you know, really thought to be delicious French fries. And in fact, when they abandoned beef tallow and went to what they looked at as heart-healthy vegetable oils, the quality of their fries went down, and so they added this sort of flavoring, chemical flavoring mixture to make the French fries taste the way they did when they came out of the beef tallow, but made in vegetable oil. And I think they got in trouble with some Hindu clients because it had actually beef in it and wasn't disclosed and all kinds of stuff. They got in trouble. But anyway, yes, tallow, lard, it's pretty good for high-temperature frying, yes.
What's so funny about what you were saying about McDonald's is this is so much of our information on food. People think exactly the wrong things are the ways to be healthy, and that if they just made those, I remember those good French, they were really good, those French fries. If they made them good still, they'd be a little healthier than they are now.
A little bit, yeah.
This is Amy Alcon. I'm with Dr. Michael Eads and Dr. Mary Dan Eads, and they are at the forefront of low-carb eating. They pioneered it way before anybody else even thought about it. Their books, two of them are Protein Power and the Protein Power Life Plan, and their site is proteinpower.com.
We'll be right back after these words. This is Amy Alcon's Human Lab on blogtalkradio.com.
I have a few more questions to ask you. If we have some time, I'd like to take some callers, too. But this is so important. A woman I'm very fond of is on statins, and I cannot persuade her, Mike, as I've read on your blog a million times, there's no benefit for statins. There's no benefit from statins for women at all. But can you talk about all the, you know, what's the truth and what's the myth on statins?
Sure. Well, first, let me correct something you said. We were not the first people to do low-carb dieting. I mean, that goes all the way back into, gosh, the 1700s. People have stumbled onto this idea that if they cut carbohydrates in the diet that they lose weight and they feel better and they get rid of health problems. And back in the 1860s, a British undertaker named William Banting was advised to go on what was called a saccharin-free diet, with saccharin meaning carbohydrate. And he did great, and he ended up was so happy about it that he published a little pamphlet that became the first best-selling diet book. And it was a low-carb book. And an interesting little tidbit on that was that in a lot of languages now, and even in English, banting means to diet. And in a lot of other languages, they've adopted that. And so to bant is to diet, based on Banting's old low-carb diet. And James Salisbury, who I think was from Cleveland and made the Salisbury steak, did that so that that would be an easy, convenient way for people to bant over here.
That's great.
Well, anyway, low-carb diet's been around a long time. Kind of our claim to fame is in Protein Power, we more or less put the science behind why it worked. People have known empirically that it's worked forever.
But that's an important thing.
You were talking about statins.
Right, that was an important thing, though, the way, and this is one of the things that's great, because it's not just, I see a lot of stuff out there, you know, in science and quote-unquote psychology, where people say, oh, this is the science, and you actually really lay it out so we know that you're not lying. So, you know, because anybody can make stuff up, and there's so much of that. And so the question was on statins, because
right.
there, It's so I see those Lipitor commercials on TV, and I want to throw something at my TV, but then I realize I can't watch
right.
my favorite shows.
Right, and if you ever listen carefully to those Lipitor commercials, they don't say anything. I mean, they don't say anything at all. It's all sort of
sleight of mouth.
Yeah, it's sleight of mouth. I mean, you think that they're saying all these things, but if you really listen to them, they don't say anything at all. They're very careful so that they don't make any claims. But what's important in taking a medicine, a medication that you're taking for the long term to treat some sort of a chronic disease, is that you want a medicine that's going to make you live longer. So let's say that you have a medicine that treats heart disease, which is a chronic disease, and treats coronary artery disease. And if it treats coronary artery disease and it doesn't have any other bad effects, you should live longer if it takes care of that. That makes sense. And so it's what researchers look at in drugs like that. They look at a parameter that's called all-cause mortality, meaning what did people die from. And so if you have a drug that supposedly helps with cardiovascular disease and you give it to one group of people and you don't give it to another group of people and you find out that they all live just as long, then you have not decreased all-cause mortality. And in other words, taking this drug is not going to make you live any longer. Now, it may help with the heart disease, but you end up dying anyway of something else, so it actually increases the risk of other things. And there's a paper that just came out this month in the Archives of Internal Medicine that showed that statins across the board seem to increase the risk of developing diabetes up to 48%. So it's thrown the statin people into a real panic. Now, this isn't a double-blind placebo-controlled study, but it's a big observational study in the Women's Health Initiative that had 153,000 women in it, and the ones that were on statins developed diabetes at a much greater rate than those that weren't on statins. So they're kind of trying to figure out how to deal with that. But at any rate, all the gold standard studies have shown that there is no decrease in all-cause mortality with statins. There is a decrease in heart disease, but people end up dying with something else instead. They don't live any longer, and the objective is to live longer. And if you look at these studies in groups of people, you find out that they confer no benefit to women whatsoever, period. Young women, old women, women that already have heart disease, women that don't have heart disease, statins are absolutely not beneficial to women, period, in terms of decreasing their all-cause mortality. If you look at men, it's a little bit different story. Men over 65, it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't help them at all. And sadly, they're the very group that are really on statins. If you look at men under 65, men that have never been diagnosed with heart disease, doesn't help them increase their all-cause mortality. The only group of people that has actually been shown to decrease all-cause mortality is men under the age of 65 who have actually been diagnosed with heart disease. Now, this means that they've had a heart problem, they've had a heart attack, they've had a coronary event. Doesn't mean that they have high cholesterol. It doesn't mean that they're eating a lot of saturated fat. It doesn't mean that they have what are called, you know, putative risk factors, which means they don't really know if they're risk factors or not. They're just assuming that they are. But men who have actually had heart disease, so if you're a male and you've never had heart disease, statins are not going to do you any good. If you have had heart disease and you're over 65 and you're a male, they're not going to do you any good. If you're a female, doesn't matter what shape you're in, they're not going to do you any good. And according to this Women's Health Initiative study that just got published, it may cause you to get diabetes. So yeah. I think statins are better off avoided, and yet they give these things like they're candy to everybody. And I can't tell you the number of people who write comments on my blog stressing because their cholesterol is up a little bit and their doctor is bullying them into going on a statin. It's just insane.
So if your doctor says you should do this, should you get a new doctor?
Well, that's a difficult call for me to make. I mean, if you're a male and you're under 65 and you've had heart disease, I wouldn't necessarily say so. But what people don't understand is that, you know, they pay their doctor for advice. And that doesn't mean they have to take the advice that the doctor gives them. They can just do the Nancy Reagan and just say no. Say, look, I've read a lot of bad things about statins, and I don't want to take them. And you know, you've made the recommendation. Put it down in the chart so you're covered. And in case I try to sue you later, you can say I begged this guy to go on statins, but he wouldn't do it. But I don't want to take them. But for some reason, people are still locked into this old school that doctors are these godlike people that if they say something, you know, you've got to do it, and you don't. I mean, hell, I've had tons of patients tell me they were going to do what I said, so you know, I know what it's like from the other end.
Right. That is such great advice. People don't think about that you can tell your doctor no, and I've done that, but I have sort of a bit of more science background than most people, and in fact, my doctor, I went in last time, and I had high cholesterol, and I know this stuff from reading you and from reading Gary Taubes, you know, about what really matters, and I know that the cholesterol, from what I've read, is protective in women, high cholesterol. I've triglycerides, they're like in the basement, they're so low, you know, I have great blood pressure, you know, and so I wasn't worried. She wanted me to come back for another test. I just ignore her, and I use her to get, you know, go to the dermatologist because it's HMO because of that. But people don't understand that, and they really feel bullied and intimidated by their doctors because, you know, they're in the white coat. That's really bad.
It's absolutely true. And if you go and you have a lipid value and you're worried about your, you know, any of your lipid values, the ones you really need to look at are your triglycerides and your HDL. And if your triglycerides are down and your HDL is up, the so-called good cholesterol, you know, you probably don't have anything to worry about, almost irrespective of what everything else is.
Right, right. I've read that in a lot of your work. Mary Dan, I wanted to talk to you about something that you wrote about people who, you know, we Americans especially have the sweet tooth, and you talked about what happens when you constantly bathe your sweet receptors with intense, you know, and even artificial and non-caloric sweetness. You know, what happens?
Well, a couple of things happen. The release of insulin in the human body is a biphasic thing, meaning that a part of it, when you first taste something sweet, the brain releases insulin in the, what's called the cephalic phase of insulin release. You release a little bit of insulin in preparation for what the body perceives as a sweet thing that's coming in. And then when the thing actually comes in, if it truly is a carbohydrate, a sugary carbohydrate, and it becomes absorbed into the bloodstream, then the body releases more insulin to handle the, you know, the surge of sugar that it needs to deal with. But when you do the same thing with artificial sweeteners, and the sweet receptors on your tongue fire off that, oh, here comes sugar, even though, I mean, they can't tell the difference, it's just sweet, you get that cephalic phase of insulin release. And then there's actually not any caloric sweetener, any carbohydrate to back it up. And so what can happen is that you can drop blood sugar by eating intensely sweet things that don't have any caloric value. And so people think, oh, I'm eating, you know, I'm using this artificial sweetener, so therefore, you know, that's not a problem. And for people who experience this, it can drive blood sugar down. And the problem with that is that one of the strongest hunger signals for the brain is a falling blood sugar. So you can end up making yourself hungry, eating more, you know, causing yourself some trouble by constantly bombarding your brain with sweets, even if it's non-caloric sweet.
That's fascinating. So people should, I was right in telling my boyfriend, cut that Diet Coke.
Well, just don't be chugging them one after the other, that's for sure.
Yeah. Oh, that's really, I think a lot of people eat that, drink that, and they don't really realize it. I think it's very important to also to not to get, you know, if you're going to get off sweets, you kind of have to get off sweets and not be dabbling.
Right. That's true. And what happens when you do that is things that you formerly didn't think were sweet suddenly became really sweet, or become really sweet to you because your receptors have kind of rehabilitated themselves, and you can eat green beans, and suddenly they taste kind of sweet.
Mm-hmm. And almonds.
And almonds and things that before you would never think of as being sweet. Once your sweet receptors have been allowed to regenerate, then they perceive all kinds of things as sweet.
So we're getting close there time-wise, but it's very important, I think, that I ask you about vitamins. You know, because I now take 5,000 IU of vitamin D because of you, and magnesium and krill oil. And can you talk about some of the benefits and why you recommend these, and if there are any others that people should be taking?
Sure. magnesium. That's probably my favorite supplement because so many people are deficient in it. Now, the last study I saw, there were 72 people that didn't even get the recommended daily intake of 72%. Magnesium. Pardon me?
72%.
Not just 72 people. No, not just 72. 72% of people didn't get the recommended daily intake of magnesium, and magnesium is a hugely important element in the human body. I mean, it's a cofactor in 300-plus enzymatic reactions. There have been numerous studies showing that people who have low magnesium levels in an ICU, for example, have very low survival compared to those that have higher magnesium levels. Low magnesium levels can predispose people to asthma. A lot of times you get people, some people get magnesium in the emergency room for asthma to help it because it helps the relax the tone of the muscular rings that encircle the airways. Magnesium is a relaxing element. It makes the bowels function better. And 72% of people don't even get the recommended daily intake, which is fairly minuscule. So I pretty much give everybody magnesium. In fact, there's a whole school of thought that says that carbohydrate intolerance is a function of magnesium deficiency. So I like to make sure that people are well magnesiumized, and it kind of helps with some of the other things too. The other important one is vitamin D. Most people don't get enough vitamin D. People that live in most parts of the United States don't get enough vitamin D in the winter. A lot of them don't get enough even in the summer. It's hugely important. Vitamin D is now, low vitamin D levels are now being correlated with all kinds of bad things. So I like to give people a pretty good dose of vitamin D. They probably ought to check their vitamin D levels if they take it. Used to be thought that you could OD on vitamin D, and you could on the old kind, but now they're making actual vitamin D, the real stuff. And so you're not nearly as likely to do that, but you probably ought to be checked if you are taking hefty doses of it. But studies have shown that, you know, monster doses of it really don't OD people like they thought they did.
Right.
Krill oil is a source of omega-3 fats that come from these little shrimp-like creatures that live up in the Arctic Ocean. And it's different than fish oil in the way the fats are hooked on to the backbone. Fats are triglycerides, krill are phospholipids. Most of our cell membranes are phospholipids. And so the krill oil is absorbed a lot easier, and you get a lot more bang for your buck. You don't have to have the high doses of krill oil that you do of fish oil to have similar results health-wise. And you don't seem to have the aftertaste and the burping and all that. And so, and there are a lot of studies on krill oil helping all kinds of things. So I prefer krill oil to fish oil.
Yeah,
down on those three.
The burping thing. And I did get tested on D, and I just wanted to say something. I learned this from you, of course, Mike, and it was a thing about you wrote a blog item on magnesium. You talk about getting the kind that ends in 8 malate, and
right.
What are the – because it's –
any kind of
malate.
It's a chelate because elemental
aspartate.
Elements get absorbed. They compete for absorption. So if you take a bunch of magnesium, it might make you deficient in zinc or copper or something else. If you take a bunch of zinc, it could make you deficient in copper or something else because they're all absorbed through the same pathway. So if you overload those pathways with one particular element, it ends up getting absorbed to the exclusion of the other ones. And what's happened is people have learned to chelate these, which means that they hook them together onto kind of a protein that gets digested instead of absorbed through these ion channels. And when they get digested, they don't compete with the other ones. And so you can always tell that you've got a chelated magnesium or potassium or whatever because it'll say, you know, magnesium aspartate, magnesium citrate, magnesium
malate.
It'll have an 8 on the end of it, and that's the giveaway that there's
a chelate.
Yeah, that it's a chelate.
It's so important. I want to tell people also, I forgot, maybe I mentioned it before, that they should look at proteinpower.com, both of your blogs. You both have blogs there, Mary Dan Eads, Dr. Mary Dan Eads and Dr. Michael Eads. And a lot of this information is there, for example, how much magnesium to take.
We'll be right back.
We don't have that much time. We're probably going to run just a little over. And for the people who are listening live, we'll post the rest of the show. It'll be posted just shortly after the show. So it might cut off for you, all of you. So I'm sorry about that. But I want to ask you, Mike, this is the last question, and we're going to go down there for this one. And this is about fiber. And there's this – every other commercial tells us to eat more fiber. And, Mike, you blog about why this is just nuts, but in rather more eloquent wording. So can you tell us about fiber?
Sure. I mean, fiber is that's the roughage, and people feel like they need fiber to get their bowels moving along as they should, and it really does work for that. But the reason that it works is because it irritates the lining of the GI tract, and this irritated lining produces mucus because mucus is the way that's sort of the defense that the lining of the GI tract has to protect itself. It produces mucus, and this mucus is kind of we all know what mucus is, sort of a fatty, slimy substance that sort of moves things along. But it's not because fiber is doing a great job. It's because fiber is actually irritating the GI tract. And a much, much better way to get your bowels moving along, I think, is just to increase your fat intake, and it'll do the same thing. And so fiber, despite all the hoopla about it, it's another one of these things like statins that have really never shown any benefit. I mean, back 20 years ago, 30 years ago, everybody was nuts about fiber and bran muffins and controlling your cholesterol with fiber and all this, and it turns out it just really didn't matter. But people still have this just absolutely drilled into their brain that they've got to have fiber, and you can get by just fine without any fiber at all.
And actually, I found that magnesium helps things come out okay, too.
Oh, yeah, magnesium helps in a big way, yeah.
It's very, very important.
Plus milk of magnesia. That's what that is that's magnesium that you take.
And for last question, MD, I wanted to just ask you about the balance between fat and protein, because that's something people wonder when they're starting a low-carb diet. You know, and I found it was very important for me to make sure I got enough fat, and that's so against what we've been taught.
Well, that's true, and I think people, because they have been so indoctrinated that they need to avoid fat, they'll go on a protein diet and they'll try to eat all very, very lean proteins and not really get enough fat, and a number of things happen. That's another thing that helps your bowels work normally, is to have enough fat in your diet. It also helps to satiate your appetite. So what we recommend for people to do is to eat an amount of good quality protein that is sufficient to feed the size lean body that person has. Obviously, it's going to be different for, a tiny gymnast than it is going to be for, you know, Ray Lewis in the NFL. I mean, it's just going to be different. But it's important that you get enough protein and an amount of carb that allows you to keep your metabolic system, balanced. And then basically the rest of your diet is good quality fat, because it's a neutral source of calories. It's not a metabolically active source of calories. You know, protein and carbohydrate both have metabolic hormonal consequences when you eat them, particularly the carbohydrate, which causes insulin to go flying through the roof. So fat is kind of a stealth nutrient. It doesn't have a metabolic hormonal effect.
Well, that's very, very important, I think, for people to know. I also, the other important thing is that you're not hungry if you eat fat. And the other thing too is that, you know, calorically, you've written about how calories, you know, yeah, you do have to watch them somewhat, but that, you know, that it matters more, you know, that you're eating this food that makes you satiated and not hungry, and then you're not going to overeat so much.
That's right.
Yeah, people that are put on low-carb diets, good quality low-carb diets, spontaneously restrict their calories.
Right.
So they tend not to overeat. They think they are, because they're eating all these things that they've thought of as forbidden foods for dieters, because they're getting to eat bacon, and they're getting to eat eggs, and they're getting to eat steak, and they're getting to do this and that, eating all these things. But when you actually sit down and run it through a calorie calculator, it turns out that it's not all that much. In fact, I posted, 7 days' worth of food, because everybody's always asking me, what do you eat, what do you eat, what do you eat? So a few years ago, I posted this on my blog. I did a photo diary, and I had people writing in and say, well, no wonder you're thin. You're only eating, 2,000 calories a day. It hadn't even occurred to me how much I ate, because I didn't calculate it. But I'm full. You know, I ate a big steak, I eat bacon, I eat eggs, I eat all these things, and it kind of, you know, it fills you up.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I wake up to 3 strips of bacon. Now, I could do another hour, but we have to go. And I just would like to say thank you so much. I've been with Dr. Michael Eads and Dr. Mary Dan Eads, and they've been at the forefront of low-carb eating and vetting the actual scientific evidence behind how to eat when everybody just believed the government's bad science. Their book is Protein Power, another is the Protein Power Life Plan, and their site is proteinpower.com. You should go there, check out their blogs. Thank you, everyone, so much for being with us.
You betcha.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm a helpful Southern California Honda dealer. You might know us from our random acts of helpfulness. Recently, we gave a veteran a brand new 50cc scooter to help him get to his appointments at the VA hospital. And we can help you get around, too, with a great deal on a reliable, award-winning Honda, like the 2016 Accord LX, a 2016 IIHS top safety pick with a built-in rear-view camera. Click the dealer locator link to find a dealer near you, and go to SoCalHondaDealers.com to suggest a random act of helpfulness for someone you know. Hey, I'm a helpful Southern California Honda dealer. You might know us from our random acts of helpfulness. Recently, we gave a veteran a brand new 50cc scooter to help him get to his appointments at the VA hospital. And we can help you get around, too, with a great deal on a reliable, award-winning Honda, like the 2016 Accord LX, a 2016 IIHS top safety pick with a built-in rear-view camera. Click the dealer locator link to find a dealer near you, and go to SoCalHondaDealers.com to suggest a random act of helpfulness for someone you know.